lightning birds.
An aeroecology of the airwaves. Where has this great stream of sound come from? This inundation of the whole country in supernatural singing. Over the center of every town in the country, these voices pour down, a silver shower of sound. Are these perhaps the voices of heaven, spirits flying low over the farmhouse roof? Velimir Khlebnikov. On a cold, windy night in 1896, the ornithologist Orrin Libby went to a hilltop a little bit west of Madison, Wisconsin. Libby had come to this spot to listen to the flight calls of migrating birds, and he wasn't disappointed. He wrote that the air above him swarmed with life and that it was a marvel and a mystery enacted under the cover of night. Nocturnal migration is normally invisible, and listening to flight calls, like looking at a radar screen, was a way to reveal its extent. He wrote that if each bird he heard was as luminous as a meteor, the heavens would blaze during the migrating season. Libby published his findings a few years later in one of the first uses of flight calls to study bird migration. Over the past three episodes of Lightning Birds, we've looked at different aspects of radio history from the perspective of bird migration. In this episode, the part of radio history that we're most concerned with has to do with sound recording technology. To understand why recording would become so important, both to radio and to the study of bird migration, let's turn our ears to the sounds that Orrin Libby was listening to that night in Wisconsin. Flight calls are the cryptic little buzzes and whistles that are emitted by birds as they fly through the air. These calls are thought to help birds keep in contact with each other and avoid collisions while in flight. They may also give the birds a sense of their distance above the ground. Flight calls are not as complex and melodious as the songs that birds sing. But flight calls do have their charms, and for one author, they are lovely in their simplicity, like Shaker hymns. Orrin Libby demonstrated that listening to flight calls could be a way to study bird migration, but it wasn't easy. To get his data, he had to listen over the course of the entire night, furiously taking notes. New technologies of sound recording could open up new possibilities for that kind of research.
I am the Edison phonograph, created by the great wizard of the New World to delight those who would have melody or be amused.
At the same time that Libby was doing his experiment in the 1890s, the first industry in recorded sound was emerging around the phonograph, invented by Thomas Edison 20 years earlier in 1877. Recording technology and radio technology developed along parallel trajectories during the first decades of the 20th century, but they overlapped and intersected in some interesting ways. Aluminum provided an important material link between the two in the form of aluminum transcription discs.
Aluminum on the march.
Sound had been etched onto aluminum discs since the 1920s, and in 1936, the NBC radio network began using aluminum discs with a thin acetate coating in order to record programs for future broadcast and to share with sponsors. Most of what we can hear today as old-time radio exists because it survived somewhere as an aluminum transcription disc. During World War II, the United States government restricted commercial use of aluminum because it was needed for the military. Radio was one of the industries hit by that wartime rationing. The door was open, you might say, for a new technology of recording sound, not on aluminum discs, but on spools of magnetic tape. German tape machines were seized by the Allies as spoils of war, and tape recording became interwoven into the fabric of radio after the 1940s in the form of on-the-spot recording.
She had three children. Two have died, and she has one alive now. Two of them were killed in the bombardment.
Broadcast transcriptions.
The Bing Crosby Show, produced and transcribed in Hollywood with John Scott Trotter and his orchestra, Judd Collins with a man.
And tape-recorded advertisements. During the post-war years, sound recording was also becoming an important tool for studying birds.
It is spring.
Tape recorders were light and portable, so they could be taken into the field.
The birds of America are in full song.
The Cornell Lab of Ornithology became a center for new techniques for recording birds.
Woods and fields, gardens and shade trees resound with their music. Each species has its characteristic song.
Cornell established a library of natural sounds in the 1950s and popularized that archive by releasing a series of birdsong records.
We will start in the garden on a spring morning. And today, the first song that greets our ears is the cheerful warble of the bluebird. There it is, singing from the roof of the birdhouse where its mate is building the nest. Chirr, calls the female. Cheer, cheerful charmer. Chuckles the male and shrugs one wing as though it really did not matter.
Advances in sound recording aided the study of birdsong, and it also inspired a new era of research on migratory flight calls. The two Illinois-based researchers we've encountered in previous episodes, William Cochran and Richard Graber, make another entrance into our story here. Graber had first told Cochran about nocturnal flight calls when they were working together on their tower kill study. Cochran suggested that they record flight calls, and in 1957, the two placed a parabolic microphone on the ground, facing upwards into the sky, and surrounded it with a baffle of straw.
Tuesday, September 1, 1959.
The microphone would record flight calls of birds who flew overhead.
The sky is practically completely overcast. I can see at least one star off to the west.
This was a kind of sonic variation on a visual method for studying nocturnal migration, which used a telescope to observe the birds that passed across the disk of the moon. You might remember that Professor Sidney Gautreau talked about that method in the last episode.
There is a definite haze on the ground, quite heavy, reducing the visibility probably to a mile.
Graber and Cochran attached their skyward-facing microphone to a reel-to-reel tape recorder, taking advantage of the post-war revolution in tape technology.
Much of the sky is overcast. This is Tuesday, September 1, 1959. The time is 8:15 p.m., 8:15 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Remember that one of the challenges to using flight calls as a research method for studying migration was that somebody like Orrin Libby had to stay up all night frantically scribbling down notes of the calls that he heard. Graber and Cochran customized their tape recorder using a large reel of tape mounted on a bicycle axle so that they could record for 8 hours.
The problem was, of course, that it only had a reel that would last. Even at the slowest speed, it only lasted, you know, an hour. And we wanted to record all night. And that's when I made the big reel that we spliced a whole bunch of tape together so we had enough tape to run all night.
That solved one problem of the flight call method, but there was still the problem of having to listen back to all that tape. And there were long stretches where nothing could be heard. So Graber and Cochran added an automatic timer.
To run all night, we had to sample, had it on for a minute and then off.
Using this technique, the team obtained valuable data about the hours and extent of nocturnal migration and the weather conditions under which it occurs. The challenge remained, though, to identify which birds were making all those cryptic little buzzes and whistles. Enter Bill Evans, who became interested in studying flight calls in the 1980s. Evans had an epiphany one night when he was camping on the St. Croix River in Minnesota. That night, he heard the calls of thousands of birds passing overhead, which he described as being like a freight train moving through the sky. The sublime immensity of that event made him think about the vast flocks of passenger pigeons that once filled the nation's skies, and he decided that he wanted to document the bird life that was here now by recording nocturnal flight calls.
Recorded by the Laboratory of Ornithology at Cornell University.
Evans came to work at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in 1994, just in time to take advantage of new software being developed there.
And now an enchanting flute-like song comes from the woodland beyond. It is a wood thrush, and it sings in measured phrases, as though it had all the time in the world, and it invited one to contemplation, something like this. Would you live with me? Away high in a tree? I'll come right down and see.
The lab had just created an application called Canary for the digital analysis of sound. Canary was a powerful tool because it could make a spectrographic image of sound, and it could do it in a much more low-cost and user-friendly way than had ever been available before. This was exactly what was needed to tell one bird's flight call from another. Bill Evans published one of the first papers to use Canary for ornithological research. In that paper, he identified previously unknown calls as belonging to the Bicknell's thrush. Thanks to new audio tools like Canary and pioneering work by people like Bill Evans, nocturnal flight calls are much easier to identify. After Bill Evans left Cornell, he started a nonprofit organization called Old Bird, which was dedicated to grow the field of flight call analysis. If Cornell's software Canary democratized the ability to spectrographically analyze and identify flight calls, the Old Bird Bucket Microphone Kit made it possible for anyone to record the flight calls of birds passing over their rooftop. It's called a bucket microphone because it's exactly that. A microphone put inside a waterproof bucket. On the Old Bird website, there's a beautiful illustration that shows the bucket microphone in use. We see birds flying over a leafy suburban neighborhood on a moonlit night. A bucket microphone can be seen on the roof of a house. And through a window, we see a young girl and boy wearing headphones, looking at a computer screen and a bird book. They're listening to their rooftop microphone and identifying the flight calls that they hear. The Old Bird rooftop microphone combines audio, computing, and ornithology in a way that I like to think of as a kind of aerospheric radio. It's a form of digital radio that decenters human voices allowing nocturnal bird migration to speak for itself through an infrastructure of microphones and computers listening to the sky. In a previous episode, we thought about radio towers reaching into the aerosphere to create a deadly obstacle for migratory birds. The mission of the old bird rooftop microphone is to create a very different kind of signal territory. In this case, we start to imagine a possible future of smart cities, where the lived environment is transformed into a vast network not of deadly towers, but of listening devices directed upwards at migratory birds. We're beginning to learn that birds listen back, turning their ears downward towards the landscapes they fly over. In fact, some people think that birds use listening as a navigational tool. A theory holds that birds use infrasound as an acoustic cue while they're in flight. Infrasound is the name given to sounds with a frequency that's lower than human ears can hear. We're listening to a recording called Air Pressure Fluctuations by the scientist and sound artist Felix Hess. Hess set up special microphones and recorded for 5 days. Then he accelerated those recordings so that 24 hours would play back in just 4 minutes. When sped up like this, very low sounds we normally can't hear become audible, revealing a whole set of infrasonic rhythms and rumblings in the world around us. Low-frequency infrasound became a hot topic of research during the Cold War because it was a way to detect nuclear explosions from far away.
The white dots that we see here are 60 infrasound stations. They monitor the globe for atmospheric or shallow underground nuclear explosions. Such explosions create infrasound waves, low-frequency waves inaudible to the human ear.
In the 1970s, studies showed that homing pigeons could perceive infrasonic frequencies. Many migratory birds hear sound at lower frequencies than humans. By one theory, low-frequency infrasonic landmarks that are inaudible to us might be serving as acoustic beacons or sonic maps.
My name is John Hagstrom, and I'm a research geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. If you could hear infrasound, you could hear earthquakes. But one of the things you would hear just constantly would be what is called the song of the sea or the voice of the sea. Waves in the deep ocean will react in a way that creates a standing wave. And a standing wave is basically a wave that just stays in the same place and goes up and down. That's what musical instruments are based on, that standing waves on strings or in pipes, all these generate a sound. And so you would hear this ocean making this constant noise. What you're hearing are what are called microbarons, and that's the surface of the water is coupling into the atmosphere and generating an acoustic wave that you hear. But these waves moving up and down also create pressure changes on the sea floor that generate a seismic wave, which is a sound wave in the earth. Those are called microseisms. The microseisms actually create movement of the landscape. When that happens, that creates infrasound. Waves in the ocean are generating these sounds in the solid earth, which are the microseisms. They are shaking the solid Earth. I mean, where you're sitting, where I'm sitting, the ground is going up ever so slightly, up and down every 6 seconds. It's so small, you can't detect it. So if you have a flat piece of ground and you're oscillating that, the sound's just going to go straight up. But if you have a steep side, if you have the side of a hill or a mountain that, you know, has a bit of a horizontal component, that will be radiating sound more in a horizontal direction. The oceans are constantly generating this energy in the Earth, which is being radiated by the topography. The birds can listen to this radiation and detect, oh, that combination of hills sounds like where my loft is or where I want to go. They're listening to the landscape. Just the way bats create an acoustic image of their environment. What they're doing is using high-frequency sound to image, but they're generating the sound that's reflected back to create a sort of sight. Well, I'm saying the birds are doing the same thing, but the sound is being generated already by the Earth, but they're using that sound to image the landscape.
Birds that fly in circles after they take flight might be orienting to these acoustic beacons.
If you have a very small antenna, to make it a big antenna, you just have to move it around. So since birds can fly, they can move their little antenna around and create a big antenna. And in particular, when you want to determine the directionality of something, the best way to do it is to Doppler shift it, which means if you're flying towards it, the frequency will go up. The sound you're hearing will go up in frequency. If you're flying away from it, the sound will go down in frequency. So if you circle around, you'll be able to detect when you're going toward it, when you're going away from it, when you're going toward it, when you're going away from it, and you can pick out the direction. And that's what birds do. When you release pigeons, they circle around, and then they leave and headed in the right direction.
In the night light, I saw the thrust forward head of the snow goose, flashing down the winding creek where Philip's sail was slanting in the gaining breeze, to fly above him in slow, wide circles.
It come flying down out of the muck and stink and smoke of Dunkirk that was overhead. It was white, with black on its wings, and it circles us like a blooming dive bomber.
I was in that show, too. Our tugboat was on its third trip back, loaded down with soldiers, when our skipper sees a derelict boat off the starboard bow. He goes off course to have a look, and we finds this here goose sitting on the gunwale guarding a man's dead body in the bottom of the boat. Struth. But that bird, well, it got up, circled three times like a plane saluting, and took off. Queer it was. Give us all a turn.
Listening to infrasound might also help to control the timing of migration. One theory holds that birds might be able to hear severe weather systems from very far away, and that could be valuable information about when to start their long-distance flights. As we've seen before, the more we learn about bird migration, the more we're forced to recognize that our uses of the aerosphere can come into conflict with theirs. One study found that the orientation of homing pigeons was disrupted by the shock waves created by supersonic airplanes. In recent years, there's been a realization that the ocean habitat is disrupted by noise pollution from commercial shipping, seismic prospecting, and military sonar. Like the ocean, the aerosphere is a habitat for sonic lifeways quite different from our own. Those non-human lifeways need to be protected from the disruptive effects of our technologies. Sound recording has helped to open our ears to the sonic dimension of bird migration, capturing the travel talk of birds in their flight calls through the night sky. Now that we've been thinking about how birds might be listening back through infrasonic perception, it makes sense to close this episode with a recording that was made by Bill Evans, the inventor of the bucket microphone. In 1993, Evans released a CD entitled Balloon Journeys, a free-floating, wild sound experience. These are recordings that were made in a helium balloon as it flew over Minnesota and Nebraska. The balloon was traveling at the same speed as the air, so there's no noise from wind. Drifting like this through the sky with the microphone pointing down, we hear an incredible clarity to the sounds coming up from below. They're being naturally amplified, reflected off the Earth's surface. We've grown accustomed to images of the Earth seen from above. Aerial photographs have been around since the 19th century. And with the rise of commercial air travel, many people could experience that view. The sonic perspective from above is less well known, typically drowned out by the noise of an aircraft. All of this makes Bill Evans' CD feel like a revelation. Evans gives us the sublime experience of listening from the perspective of migratory birds, hearing the subtle frequencies that might serve as an auditory map that guides their nocturnal flights. A number of scholars have critiqued the view from above for being distant, detached, and abstract, as opposed to a more ground-level, embodied experience to be had from walking on the street. But for migratory birds, the sky is a street, and the sonic experience of that space is embodied and social, buzzing with the chatty communication of flight calls. Balloon Journeys lets us hear the ambient background of that travel talk and gives us a lesson in non-human ways of aerospheric listening. In Radio of the Future, Velimir Khlebnikov writes of radio as a silver shower of sound that surges down on us from above like the voices of heaven. Bill Evans has found a way to capture a silver shower of sound that surges up from below, temporarily giving us the ears of angels. Lightning Birds was written and produced by me, Jake Smith, and published in 2020 by the University of Michigan Press under a Creative Commons NC license. Post-production is by Liam Davis. And the theme music you're hearing is by Dominic Uhlberg. You can find all 5 episodes of Lightning Birds and learn more about the project at www.press.umich.edu/p/lightningbirds. Thanks for listening.